Tonight, we're going to cover the subject of Habakkuk. So it's an interesting book and has some things that we can learn from it. And also, Habakkuk is a short book, but it's not the easiest book to read. And I'll explain why here in a minute. When the book of Habakkuk begins, it begins with Habakkuk declaring himself to be a prophet in Habakkuk verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1. He says the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. So right from the very beginning, he tells his audience that he was a prophet, and he calls himself a prophet, which probably signals the fact that he was a prophet, a professional prophet, and that meant that he had been trained to serve in that capacity in probably primarily at the temple. For instance, it's likely that he was a Levite. He possibly could have been a priest, but more likely a Levite. And the comment he was likely a Levite comes from the fact that he writes. He notates and assigns music in a manner that fits someone who worked in music in the temple, and we'll see why that's the case. So we'll learn more about that here a little bit later as we look at it. But it's likely that, you know, that he wrote music, that he played music in the temple, and that he was busy in that particular way in the service of the people of God. So unusually, scholars and students agree on the date of the book. It's dated to around 600 BC. And so it's great events had taken place before 600 and are going to take place after 600. Does anybody know how many captivities that Judah experienced? Or I could say it another way, how many waves of captivity did Judah go through? As you look at the facts from the Bible, we find that there were two big captivities that Judah experienced. First of all, Judah went into captivity in 597 BC. During that captivity, we have Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and all of the important people in Judah being carried away into captivity. So that was the first wave that they went through. And the second wave was the most devastating wave that took place in 586 BC. And basically what took place then is everybody that was left from the first captivity was taken into captivity. So that's when the temple was destroyed. That's when everything about Judah was wiped out and carried off to Babylon. So Habakkuk is writing on the doorstep of the first captivity. So if he's writing around 600, then in 597, one of the first captivity takes place, and lots of people that I'm sure Habakkuk know were carried away captive. So he's basically prophesying 3 years before this captivity hits the people of Judah. So Habakkuk is, as you look at the book, it's not an easy book to read. You think, well, it's short, so it'll probably be an easy read, but in fact, it's not. In reading through the book, we find about five passages that are we would be able to relate to because they're commonly repeated in people quoting from the Bible. But other than those five passages, it's kind of like wading through a book and you're trying to go through it and note something that you can latch onto that's memorable. Otherwise, sometimes it's a little bit hard for us to find things that we might grasp onto. So to begin with, let's start in Habakkuk chapter 3. Habakkuk 3 is ranked by Hebrew scholars as one of the finest examples of Hebrew poetry in existence. It's a very fine piece of Hebrew poetry. We are familiar with our English poets. You know, we have a Longfellow or Shakespeare and other great English poets that we're familiar with as English speaking people. But we're familiar with those individuals who were poets. And Habakkuk was such a poet. He was a writer of poetry, and it's reflected in the book of Habakkuk. If you're going to categorize Habakkuk, one way that you might categorize it is it's liturgical, which means it's it's worship poetry. That is poetry that could be used in church. So it's a poetic book. Because it's written in English, we may not readily note that, but if you read it in Hebrew, it becomes very clear that it is a poetic book. As you look at Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1, that particular verse is interesting. It says in that verse, it says, a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, Shigionoth. And so that's not a common word that we use. And as you look at what it says in that verse, it says a prayer of the prophet on Shigionoth. And Habakkuk identifies himself as a prophet, but scholars really don't understand exactly what that difficult word for me to pronounce is, what it means. They don't know exactly. What they do know is that it's probably some form of musical notation. It has something to do with the music and the musical aspect of this particular book. So we see that, and it tells us that it's some sort of a musical notation that tells those who are going to be playing it, singing it, or whatever was done, they would know what that notation meant, and it would be a guide for them as they're playing whatever it is that that meant. Also, as you look in your Bible, you'll see three different locations where the word Selah, S-E-L-A-H, is used. And Selah is a musical notation. Basically, Selah is used 71 times in the Psalms, and it's used three times elsewhere, and elsewhere is in the book of Habakkuk. And we find those three uses of that in Habakkuk chapter 3. So it's a musical notation. Selah means basically a pause or suspend. It would be equivalent to a rest in music that we would be playing. You notice how the book ends with a notation in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 13. It says there, to the chief musician, with my stringed instruments. So it's a note to the chief musician, and talks about stringed instruments, which would be used in playing this particular piece. If you look at the Kyle and Delish commentary on the Old Testament, it has a good comment about this particular book. And the end of the book, verses 18 and 19 of Habakkuk 3, it says the following about that passage. The last words do not form part of the contents of the ode, but are a superscript subscription answering to the heading in verse 1, that is in Habakkuk 3, verse 1. And refer to the use of the ode in the worship of God, and simply differ from other headings that are found in various places in the Psalms. Through the words to the president of the temple music or the conductor, in accompaniment of my stringed playing, the prophet appoints himself, appoints his psalm for use in the public worship of God, accompanied by a stringed instrument. So this was a piece of prophecy that was actually to be played in the temple. Going on, the comment goes this way in verses regarding 18, verses 18 and 19. But if the prophet, by using this formula, stipulates that the ode is to be used in the temple, accompanied by stringed instruments, the expression that is there that for me would be unpronounceable, with temple accompanied by stringed instruments, the expression with my stringed playing affirms that he himself will accompany it with his own playing. So this is a notation that Habakkuk was inspired to write down that would give guidance and direction as to how this piece would be played in the temple, and he apparently actually accompanied it with his instrument. So, and outside of Psalms, as you look at the book of Habakkuk, it is the most musical book in the Old Testament, as short as it is. In Habakkuk, we apparently have a qualified songwriter, a musician who can play at the caliber that was required in the temple. And the temple was interesting because you had millions of people from whom you could draw for playing instruments, for being singers, and for being part of the service in the temple. So you had the best of the best from the land of Israel to serve in these capacities. So you had a very fine choir, you had a very fine instruments that were playing, and the music in the temple, I'm sure, was something special, which we'll be able to enjoy as God's kingdom is established. If you go back to the dedication of the temple back in Solomon's time, David did a lot of work to set up all of the music that would take place in the temple, and all of that organization and effort came to fruition in Solomon's time as the temple was dedicated. And so you had the temple musicians and singers who were the very best in the land of Israel. And they were able to provide all of the music that would accompany the worship of the great God. And it is interesting what you see here in the book of Habakkuk, and you see all of these references to music, and it's something that we would not note necessarily unless we took time to do some research and gain insight into what Habakkuk is saying and doing as far as this is concerned. To help you ponder the points that he makes, I'll give you the structure of the book and the reasoning behind his statements, along with God's response. So we'll start with looking at the structure of the book and the reasoning behind Habakkuk's statements, and along with God's responses. So let's look at the structural outline of the book. So as we begin in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw." And we've looked at that word before. And the word burden is always a bad word, meaning something negative, meaning doom, meaning destruction and upheaval. And so Habakkuk had to carry this message to the people of Judah. And it was a heavy burden that he had to carry to deliver to them. And God asked him to relay this message to the people of Judah. Verse 2, it says there, "O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear, even cry out to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless. And justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment precedes. So he's telling them that that it's going to be bad ahead of them. You know, when the law is powerless, we live in an age where that's becoming more and more of a reality, but it was a reality in Judah. And, you know, when you have a situation where justice never goes forth and wickedness prevails, it's a bad time in your society. And that's where we're at, unfortunately. So that's what Habakkuk said. He said this to God, expressing to him what he observed. And then God replies, beginning in verse 5. And he says, "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty people, nation which marches through the breadth of the earth." So God is going to bring the Chaldeans into the land of the people of Judah, and he is going to use them to punish the nation of Judah. So he's saying the Chaldeans are coming. We would also know them as the Babylonians. They are coming, and they are going to conquer the people of Judah. He's telling them this and telling them about the people that are coming their way. And it goes on to say in verse 6, "To possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and more fierce than themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards and evening and fiercer than evening wolves. Their charges charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come to violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. And they deride every stronghold. For they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits an offense, ascribing his power to his God." So what's happening here in verses 1 through 4 is Habakkuk is lamenting the state of the nation. And he's bringing up to God, look at the condition of our nation. And don't you notice that? He's asking if God even sees it. And he can't understand why God isn't doing something about it. So he expresses that in the first four verses of the book. And he's wondering why God's not acting. And, you know, Habakkuk basically says that he knows that God is righteous. And he's asking, how long, God, are you going to put up with all of this iniquity that's going on, not only in our land, but as you look at the people that you're going to use it as an instrument against Judah, they're worse than we are, is one of the things he notes. So you can sit down and we can read verses 1 through 4, and we can pretty well understand what he's saying. And he's telling God, here's what's going on in my country. It's wrong, and I know that you can see it even better than I can. How come you aren't doing anything about it? So he noted the terrible things going on in his country, and he wondered why God wasn't doing anything. And he's going, and God tells him in verses 5 through 11 that he's going to use the Chaldeans to come and punish Judah. Just as he used Assyria to come and punish the people of Israel, well, the same thing is going to be inflicted upon the people of Judah through the nation of Babylon or Chaldea. As you look at the term Chaldea or Chaldeans, what does that refer to? Well, if you go and you look at a map of the area of Babylon, then you'll see that Chaldea was basically to the eastern portion of the land of Babylon. They were a portion of the land of Babylon. And in fact, if you were to go into that land, one of the characteristics of it was a basically marshland, swampland. It wasn't the ideal land for farming. And if you go into that land, you find some very interesting boats and houses. You had rush houses that were built on the water, and people lived on the water, and it was just, they had accommodated themselves to it and were able to make the best of it. The people of Chaldea were somewhat like the Scots in Great Britain. The Scots were a rough people that were quick to fight, and the Chaldeans were the same. They were cantankerous. They were hard to get along with. They were always willing to fight. That was common to the Scots, and because of their nature being cantankerous and being willing to fight and contentious, they eventually became the most powerful group in the kingdom of Babylon. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar was a Chaldean. And as you look at Nebuchadnezzar, he was kind of difficult to get along with and was known for being quick to anger. And so he inherited those characteristics as being a Chaldean. Because of the dominance of the Chaldeans among the Babylonian peoples, then the Babylonians were also known as Chaldeans, and Chaldea became synonymous with Babylonia. And as I said, the Chaldeans were were found in the southern and eastern part of the land of Babylon. So God simply tells Habakkuk as he begins the book that I do see the sins of Judah. None of this has escaped me. I'm watching. I know exactly what's going on, and I'm going to use the Chaldeans to do the punishing. So I see what's going on. I see how the different inequities and problems that Judah has, and I'm going to use the Babylonians to punish the people of Judah unless they repent. And then comes a second question. You know, God, Habakkuk wonders why God isn't taking action, and God tells him, "I am going to take action. Just wait for it." And then when God tells Habakkuk that he's going to be using the Babylonians to carry out his will in punishing Judah, then that causes a second question to be raised. And the question that Habakkuk offers up to God is, well, wait a minute. You know, the people of Judah are bad and they deserve punishment, but you're going to use a people who are worse in their behavior and their conduct than the people of Judah. You're going to use a people that is worse than the Jews in order to punish the Jews. He did not understand that. The people were the Babylonians were more wicked than Judah, but God was going to use them to accomplish his purpose. And for Habakkuk, that was a hard thing for him to understand. As you go through this, as you get to Habakkuk chapter 1:12, we find a verse there that's quoted quite often, Habakkuk 1 verse 12. And there it says, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord. You have appointed them for judgment. O Rock, you have marked them for correction." So, you know, when he uses this term, he calls him the Rock, O Rock, and calls him by names, the Holy One. Those were all titles that were God's that date all the way back to Moses. You know, as you look at the people of Israel coming out of Egypt, you know, they were the rock accompanied them all the way out of Egypt and on the road to the land of promise. And the rock is one of God's titles. That rock who followed them was Jesus Christ, we know. In verse 13, it says, "You are purer than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Why do you make men like a fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them?" And so he's questioning God. Basically, he wants to know why things are the way they are. Now let's pick up in chapter two. So Habakkuk has talked to God. He has made his point, and then he continues on. And in chapter 2, verse 1, he says, "I will stand my watch. I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart." So I'm going to go up on the wall of the city, up onto the defensive portions of the city where I can look out from there. And I'm going to watch to see what God will say to me. I'm going to stand up there and await for God to respond to my question and what I will answer when I am corrected. So he knew that what he was asking, God might answer and God may correct him when he did answer. So he knew that was possible. So he wanted an answer. He wanted to understand why God was acting in the way that he was reacting. And he had developed such a close relationship with God that he knows if he's talking back and forth with God, that there can be correction. And he's willing to accept that if that's necessary. So all the way from verse 2 to the end of the chapter, God's answer to Habakkuk is laid out in 5 different woes. And in doing so, God is telling Habakkuk, "You asked if I know what the people of Babylon are like. I know what Israel's like, and I also know what the people of Babylon are like." And so he lays out what he wants Habakkuk to understand about the Babylonians in 5 different woes that he lays out. He begins in chapter 2, verse 4. In chapter 2, verse 4, he says, "Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith." Now, for most of us, we're well aware of that particular verse. It's a verse that was quoted by the Apostle James in his book in the New Testament. He tells us that we are to live by faith, and that's a fundamental proposition for us as God's people, whether in the Old Testament or in the New. And it's almost exact quote, except for one word that is different here than it is in the book of James. God does things at times that, you know, we don't understand. That's why we have to walk by faith. He can take a long time to do something that between the start of it and the end of it, we don't exactly see where it's going. You know, God sometimes doesn't do things quickly, but he may begin a process and the process doesn't go as quickly as we want. But eventually God will finish it and God will bring about what he wants to accomplish. As we face these situations where the path ahead isn't clear, then we have to make a choice. If I don't understand what's going on, what do I do? What do I do? And if I see the start, but it goes on long enough that I can't see the end, what am I supposed to do? And I think we all face those kinds of things with various circumstances that we've either been through or we're going through or that we will go through. And sometimes it's hard for us to see exactly what God is seeking to accomplish, but we have to, whatever the circumstance, continue to walk by faith, trusting that it's all, that God is going to work it all out to our benefit in the way that is best for us in the long run. And so this was where Habakkuk was at. So he saw the need for Judah to be corrected, but he saw the inequity of the Babylonians taking on that responsibility to punish the people of Judah. And he wondered, well, how can God do this when the people of Babylon are actually worse than the Jews? And so he knew, God knew that his people were wrong, and Habakkuk knew that God was just, and they're not getting away with whatever they're doing. And God's reply is, they're not getting away, with it. You can count on that. I, in fact, am going to use the Chaldeans to accomplish my purpose. And so it's kind of a confusing situation for Habakkuk. And at times, sometimes we see things take place that don't seem fair, but we can always trust that God is fair and that it will all work out right in the end. So Habakkuk is not understanding, and God is saying to him as a gentle nudge, if you're thin-skinned, you're going to be offended. If you're not thin-skinned, then you can learn certain lessons from what I'm doing and how I'm accomplishing it. And so we find God mapping out for Habakkuk the woes that he's going to bring to pass. And what he's going to do in this chapter is he's saying it's good in the end what I want to work out. So let's begin. Let's just consider the gist of verses 4-8. I won't read the verses, but we'll look at, we'll consider what verses 4-8 say. Yeah, these verses describe the aggressiveness and the greed of the people that God is going to use to punish Judah. They are quite aggressive. They are quite greedy. And if you think about the book of Daniel in this light, as I said, Nebuchadnezzar was a Chaldean. And if you look at the book of Daniel, where it talks about Nebuchadnezzar before he lost his mind, if you look at what he was like before then you can see that he was pretty greedy. He was pretty desirous of power. He was quite aggressive. And as God worked with him, he came more pliable, but he was not at the beginning. So God corrects him, as I said, by allowing him to lose his mind and his kingdom for 7 years. And he was humbled during that time, and he came back a changed man. But as he speaks in verses 4-8, he condemns the Chaldeans for their aggressiveness and greed. So they were quite aggressive as they were conquering other peoples, quite greedy in the way that they approached those people. And God said, I know this is the way they are, but I'm going to use them for my purpose. Verses 9-11, here it pronounces a woe on the people of Babylon for their exploitation. He tells them that the Babylonians are going to exploit other people. They're going to exploit the Jews and the people of Judah, and pronounces a woe on them for that inappropriate approach. In verses 12-14, God says that I will deal with them because of their violence. And they were quite a violent people in their conquest. And as they took over other nations, they were going to exceed what God wanted them to do. He wanted them to conquer Judah, but he also wanted them to be reasonable about it. But unfortunately, like most people do when they get involved in a war situation and they're faced with they get carried away and unfortunately take things too far. People don't know how to limit themselves as far as inflicting punishment on others. So God knows about the Chaldeans, and he is going to call them on the carpet for this. He is going to deal with them as they get too carried away. It's interesting when Daniel starts to reveal to Nebuchadnezzar all the facts of life about his relationship with God. He says, God has given you the ability to be the first world ruler. So in dealing with Babylon, he allows Nebuchadnezzar to be the first world ruler in the first kingdom, of which it's the first one, but there will be other kingdoms coming, and each kingdom that comes is going to be of lesser quality, lesser value than Babylon. Babylon had its problems, but it says it was the head of gold. And what comes after it with the silver and the other metals is inferior to gold. So he said, you're going to be the best of these kingdoms, and what comes after you gets worse and worse. And as you think about Babylon, Babylon was a great world-ruling empire, but what's astounding is how short their position of power was. They didn't rule for centuries. If you look at the Assyrians, they ruled from the time of the judges all the way down to 700 BC, approximately 700 years. And so they would ebb and flow. They would be very powerful. They would be weakened, but they continued on as a kingdom until their great fall in around 600, and they just disappeared from the scene. But the people of Babylon, they were very powerful for a time, and then they rose quickly and they fell quickly. Basically, they disappeared as the most powerful and feared nation on earth in the blink of an eye. As you start naming the kings of Babylon, you had Nebuchadnezzar's father, then you had Nebuchadnezzar, and as you look at the kings, it's a very short time between Nebuchadnezzar and the words Mene Tekel Upharsin being written on the wall at Belshazzar's feast. It was not a very long period of time at all. And the Babylonian Empire fell very quickly. And they didn't disappear from the scene completely, but they weren't a world ruling power any longer. So God is laying out for Habakkuk what's going to happen. And you have to understand that all of it unfolds in God's time. And it can be a blink of an eye, or it can be more lengthy. But God does things according to his timeline, not our timeline. And we can count on that. As you look further into the book of Habakkuk, chapter 2, talks about in verses 15 through 17, the immorality of the Chaldeans. God saw that they were immoral. And then we look at verses 18 through 20, and we're told how idolatrous they were. There were many gods that the Babylonians worshiped, and God saw all of that. God knew all of that. So a simple way to summarize chapter 2 is that Habakkuk went up on the rampart, on the wall of the city, to await God's response. And God responds to Habakkuk by saying, I know the Babylonians. I know they've got their flaws, most assuredly. And he laid out what the flaws were. And he spelled out that there would be woes for each of those flaws. But but that doesn't remove Judah's guilt and Judah's need for correction. And God is going to use the Chaldeans for his purpose to correct Judah. And as you look at what God is laying out in chapter 2, that's in summary what God is wanting Habakkuk to understand, and what we can understand about the book, that it does detail the God's using the Chaldeans for his purpose, and God being aware of Judah's flaws and the Chaldeans' flaws, and God is going to deal with them accordingly. So the third chapter is basically a song of respect and praise and admiration for God that follows these conversations between Habakkuk and God. So after these conversations have taken place, Habakkuk's lament and God's statement and Habakkuk scratching his head because he doesn't understand, and God's response, then comes this phenomenal piece of Hebrew music. It would be interesting to hear how this piece of music was written and played and sung. I'm sure in God's kingdom we'll have that opportunity to hear it sung and performed and enjoy this piece of music that was to be performed in the temple. And it will be part of God's musical presentations that will take place. As we see that it talks about the musical notations where it says, I will accompany on the stringed instrument the performance of the music in church. And that's what chapter 3 is all about. And there are verses that are as of a level that immediately resonate with people. For instance, when the prophet uses the term rock, we all know what that term means. You know, it's the rock of Israel. And that was a common title for Jesus. In fact, it's used in 1 Corinthians. It calls him the rock that accompanied Israel in the wilderness. And it's used to describe our God. And then you have the statement about the just shall live by faith, which is a fundamental part of our belief. And, you know, it's something that was quoted by James in his book later on. One of the great challenges for readers of the prophets is that most people do not have a high degree of understanding of where the prophets are coming from. You know, we read it, but we really don't know much about it. And we don't know where the prophets are coming from, because if we did, it would be easier for us to understand. And I think it's of value for us to take the time to try to understand where they're coming from. If you were like me, when I began to read through the Bible, I didn't know much about it. I knew about Jesus being our Savior. I knew a few things like that, but I didn't know about Israel. I didn't know anything about Judah. I knew nothing about the history of God's people. You saw these people mentioned about, they were called patriarchs. Well, who are they? I didn't understand any of that, and probably many of you didn't as well. And so it's worthwhile becoming familiarized with those things, because they will help you understand the overall Bible and what it's about and what's important and what's not important. And we can understand the historical periods that play out. Now, we don't have to understand everything, but we can try to understand the basics that allow us to gain greater insight into it. I know that when we were learning about the Bible, one of the resources that was made available to us was a book called, it's an old book. It's written by Charles Pfeiffer. The last name is Pfeiffer. And he wrote a book called Old Testament History. And it's a pretty straightforward book. I know that when Liz and I were trying to figure out what's going on and what the overall gist of things were, this book was very helpful in helping us to get the overall theme and the timing of things and get things nailed down. And even though it is an older book, you know, if you're interested in understanding the history of the Bible more fully, it's a book that's well worth purchasing. You can buy it used, and because it's no longer published, but you can find copies of it around, and we still have ours from years ago. As we're going to go through now till the end of the study this evening, and I'm going to quote from a historical book called A History of Israel by a historian by the name of John Bright. And he says some interesting things about what's taking place here in the book of Habakkuk and the time period and the mindset of the people of Judah as everything is unfolding and their nation is getting ready to fall. So I'm going to quote from John Bright beginning on page 309. And it says, beginning in on that page, between the death of Hezekiah and the final fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians, there lay precisely a century, from 687 to 587. Seldom has a nation experienced so many sudden reversals of fortune in so relatively a short a time. Through the first half of the period, they were a vassal of Assyria. Judah then knew in rapid succession periods of independence and subjection. First to Egypt, and then to Babylon, before finally destroying herself in a feudal rebellion. Basically, they committed national suicide by rebelling against those who had taken them, who had conquered them. So quickly did these phases follow one another that it was possible for one man to live through the whole period. And the man that did live through all of it we know him as Jeremiah. He witnessed them all. And so even though Jeremiah didn't live 100 years, he was able to see the beginning portions of the downfall of Judah and follow it all the way through to the end. He was there when it all came to a close, when the Babylonians conquered the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the city and the temple and carried the people away captive. Bright goes on to say, our major biblical sources, the books of Kings and Chronicles, are rather meager and leave many gaps. Considerable additional information, however, is yielded by the books of the prophets who functioned during this time, especially Jeremiah, but also Ezekiel, Zephaniah, Nahum, and Habakkuk. So in terms of understanding that period of time, these prophetic books all help us to get a better insight, you know, using the books of Kings and Chronicles and looking at the end portions of those books, we can see what was unfolding. Page 331 of John Bright, he says, we shall return in the next chapter to consider the nature of the crisis, both physical and spiritual, in which the fall of Jerusalem plunged the last remnant of the Israelite nation, and the manner in which she survived it. Yet it must be noted here that survival was made possible in no small part because prophets who addressed the nation in the hour of her bitterest agony had already in advance of the tragedy met the theological problems involved in it. So the prophets were there and they sought to interpret what was taking place and to relay to the people what they observed, and it helped the people cope with what was happening. So Jeremiah helped in that way, and also you had not only Jeremiah as a true prophet, you had false prophets who were preaching a certain message that undermined the people and didn't help the people because they did not deal straight with them. And so going on here, we move to the next section, which talks about a national theological crisis. It says there, anyone who has grasped the nature of Judah's national theology as popularly understood will see that it was totally unprepared to meet the emergency that was impending. The nation was going to fall. They were being invaded and they had no clue how to deal with it, no clue whatsoever. And this theology, as we have said before, centered in the affirmation of Yahweh's choice of Zion as his seat, and his immutable promises to the Davidic dynasty of an eternal rule and victory over its foes. So what were the prophets telling the people of Judah? They were telling them, first of all, we have the temple, we have the Ark of the Covenant, we have the Davidic king, we have everything going for us, and God, and this is the holy city, God is not going to let this city and its people fall. And that was the basic idea that they had. That was fundamental to who they were, what they were, and what they believed. And unfortunately, they did not understand where they were at and where God was going. So they had this particular theological point of view. And if you look at our country has a point of view also. Unfortunately, we've moved away from God in a rather dramatic way, but there's a certain element that believes that God is never going to let this country fall. You look at how many times God has delivered us and blessed us, and look at all of the great blessings that we've had as a nation, and God isn't going to let us fall. Well, that's not true. It wasn't true for Israel, it wasn't true for Judah, and it isn't true for us either. Going back to John Bright, he says, Isaiah did not, however, surrender that theology, but rather reaffirmed it on a deeper level. So he's preaching to the people of Judah, and he's laying it out for them, and he's telling them the truth, whether they want to hear it or not. But his assurance to Hezekiah that Jerusalem would not be taken so dramatically, was so dramatically vindicated by events, plus the collapse of Assyria, which came later and seemed to fulfill his words, conspired to establish the inviolability. That is, Judah could never fall. Judah could never fall. So God delivered Judah from the Assyrians. He allowed the Assyrians to conquer them all the way up to the city of Jerusalem, and they're just on the brink of falling. And Isaiah was there, and King Hezekiah, and Isaiah encouraged Hezekiah to hang on and don't give in to the Assyrians. And eventually, God intervened and destroyed 100,000 soldiers that were before the city gates of Jerusalem, destroyed that army. And this was something that the people took heart in, and they believed that's what took place. And so they expected that God would continue to watch over them and protect them. But as you look at what's unfolding, that's what they believe, but that's not what's really going to take place. As they looked at, so Hezekiah dies, and eventually Josiah comes on as the Davidic king. So he's in power, and he is a righteous king who seeks to restore the true religion in the among the people of Judah. And so they expected Josiah to lead them. They had great confidence in Josiah because he was doing the right thing. And the next thing you know, Josiah decides to take on the Pharaoh of Egypt and fight him, and dies in battle. So for the people of Judah, this is a devastating blow. Here is the Davidic king that they have confidence in, and he's killed in battle. How does that reassure us that God is going to watch over us and protect us? So what happens is they believe that they can't fall, that they're going to make it, that they're going to come through this. Times may get tough, but they're going to get through this. So that was their belief all the way until the Babylonians breached the city walls and entered the city and killed vast numbers of them and carried them away into captivity. So they believed that God was going to protect them. And so that's why they listened to the other kings who rebelled against different rulers, when really that was not the right path. They could be a subject people, and they would be safe from the going into captivity, but they were willing to rebel and to follow the various kings who advocated a rebellion against those who were serving them as rulers. And that's why they followed Zedekiah and the other kings in kind of a suicide, national suicide, rebelling against those who were in power. So unfortunately, they did not see the reality. And up until the time when the city of Jerusalem fell, they believed God was going to save them. They were God's chosen people. The temple was there, and God would never allow the temple or the city to be destroyed. When their behavior had become so far off base that God said, no, I'm going to use the Babylonians to inflict my correction upon you. So as you come to the end of the book, that will end here shortly, we come to the end of chapter 2 and verse 20. And it says that the Lord is in his temple. That was a statement that was made. The Lord is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And that's true. It was true at that time, and it's still true today. No matter what goes on, the Lord is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silence. So God has said, I don't have to come down on your level and deal with every issue, large or small, that you may have. But you need to understand, first, that the just shall live by faith. That's what we all must do between here and the end of the age. And, you know, God wanted Habakkuk to understand that, and he wants us to understand it. And secondly, God is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. In other words, keep silent because you can trust that God has everything in hand. And that's going to be a real challenge if things really turn sour. Will we continue to have confidence that God is in his temple and that we can trust that God is going to work everything out according to his purpose? God knows everything that's going on. Nothing has escaped him. He sees it all, both our sins and the sins of the world. He sees it all. And God is aware of his people, and we don't therefore have to worry. That we don't understand everything is not relevant. That means we're not going to see everything. We're not going to understand everything, but we can trust that what's going to play out is for the best overall. So that's where we exercise faith. And that's what we have to do to the end. So this completes the 3-chapter book of Habakkuk. I hope that you found it profitable. And the next book that we're going to take a look at will be Zephaniah. And that probably won't take place until after the feast. We will have a Bible study at the beginning of September, but we will come back to the minor prophets, and we'll finish them this year before the end of the year.